listening to Tidings, and this is Hazel Khan. Today I bring you tidings from Pakistan, where I've recently returned from what was intended to be a sentimental journey to Lahore, the town of my birth. That it was, but I was also drawn into all the intriguing complexity that is Pakistan today. I'd been away for 40 years, so chronicling change was central to my conversations and my observations. Yes, indeed, a lot can change in 40 years. I just have to look in the mirror to know that. Lahore is now a city of 10 million people, and with it the frantic traffic, new suburbs and box stores that come with such expansion. But you can't miss the ubiquitous bearded men of all ages, unambiguous proof that religious fundamentalists have become a major force in my once tranquil birthplace. Another important change is the new schools in Lahore, so many that rush hour traffic peaks at the start and close of the school day, as parents and drivers transport children to these numerous schools. When I was growing up in Pakistan, education was accessible to anybody who really wanted it. Today, the deteriorated government-run system is one of many indicators of a failing state, one that does not serve its people. Yet I would caution against dismissing Pakistan as a hopeless country ruled by unreliable terrorists who hate America. That is only one among many of its stories. Beware of the single story. There's no such thing. Pakistanis care very deeply about their country and are in despair about its militaristic, corrupt, and lawless trajectory. In my conversations, they told me that power must be transferred to a civilian government if it is to provide the solutions that the military-religious complex has failed to provide. I also spoke with individuals who are actively bringing change, their efforts informed as much by self-interest as by philanthropy. They want to do the right thing, but they also want to use their power to create a neighborhood and a country that they want to live in. You'll hear my conversations with two of these people. Bina Raza is an educator and social entrepreneur, deeply engaged in a school for poor girls in a semi-industrial area of Lahore. Her work is implementing the vision of her father, Raza Kazim, who believes that secular, educated, and enlightened women must be an essential component of Pakistan's future leaders. I asked Bina, when and why did the healthy situation we knew 40 years ago give way to the dismal situation of today? What is the context for this intense new focus on education in Pakistan? The changes began, she told me, when the socialist Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the father of Benazir Bhutto, came into power in the early 70s. His rallying cry, Roti Kapra Makan, which is bread, clothing, shelter.
He was a leader with a socialist mindset, but he's the one who nationalized a lot of the schools. The fallout of the nationalization policy of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was that a lot of these schools, which are very affordable schools, good quality education, whether they were government schools or these so-called missionary private schools, which were extremely affordable, all the elitist families, the middle class families, the low middle class were able to send their kids to the same school. So with Bhutto's nationalization policy, there's this whole new challenge of decline in education. He's the one who used Islam as a political card, as a trump card. And unfortunately, education was hard hit by that so-called, I would say, game of chess that he tried, because the tail end of his years, he had made lots of enemies by that time. So he, in a desperate attempt, he did a whole shift in the schools by nationalizing schools, introducing Islamic studies and Quran as compulsory, and made huge shifts in the curriculum, introducing Pakistan studies as a very, very, actually as a compulsory mandatory subject, which really took the historical context out of our social studies curriculum. So there were multiple factors which really initiated this downfall and decline in the quality of education and the delivery of education.
Bhutto was succeeded by President Zia-ul-Haq, who saw as his mandate the transformation of Pakistan into an Islamic society. His position was strengthened during the Afghanistan war against the Russians, after which the American and Pakistani-trained Mujahideen were left without mission or leaders. Thousands of disbanded, angry, uprooted, and armed young men then found a new home, purpose, and patronage in Pakistan's madrasas, which then became transformed from their historical role as centers of learning to centers of militant training. Are the madrasas still succeeding in increasing in number? I asked Bina.
At the rural level, it's just 1% of these institutions which are there compared to the network of government schools. So they're very small in number, but they have a huge impact. In the urban centers, it's about 2%. So interesting that how the small fringe element of educational delivery sites are able to have this huge impact. And that just shows that the need for good, decent schools is huge, because dearth of the state fulfilling its obligations. So we do have a lot of these non-elite schools which have mushroomed up, especially in the urban, peri-urban centers, which charge about nominal fee, about 250, 350, 400.
Explain what that is. That's about $5 a month, $3, $4, $5 a month?
Yeah, about, under $10, exactly, $5 to $8 a month. So those are the non-elite schools which have mushroomed all over, especially the peri-urban areas, urban areas, to some extent in rural areas, but not so much in the rural areas. But they do cater to about 30-35% of the school-going, children. And the rest, majority, they go to the public schools. And just a small minority goes to these madrasas, but they have a huge impact. Because in madrasas, those kids go who really are from the poorest families, because madrasas give them 3 meals a day. They give proper facilities. They give them housing. They give them shelter. They give them food. And they give them some literacy skills.
They give them shelter as well?
Yeah. They are boarding schools also. The fact that the children will be able to read the Quran and be literate, they can read and write, get some numeracy skills, some writing skills and reading skills, and yet get three meals and some decent space.
So if madrasas then are filling a void and fulfilling a need for boys, what about the girls? I asked Bina.
The majority goes to the public schools, the government schools, which are free. So a lot of them end up finishing the primary years, which is grade 5. Especially the girls drop out after grade 5, because a lot of these girls have issues of access, because the middle school, that means grade 5 to 8, would be very far away. And parents do not want to send girls, especially girls, alone and or walk to these schools. So a lot of these girls end up dropping out of school after grade 5. And the other interesting thing is that steadily the government expenditure that it commits to education is declining. And it's shocking that in the past 2 years, it's been one of the lowest ever in the history of Pakistan. So it's maximum 1.5% of GDP that we spend on education. There's a huge void. And compared to Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, India, these are countries that spend at least anywhere between 3.5-4% and above on education. And Pakistan is one of the countries in South Asian region with lowest GDP on education. So historically, it's just getting from bad to worse. So education is in crisis, but interestingly, parents realize that the only way they can you know, have a future for the children is through education.
So into this breach, into this vacuum, you and your organization have stepped and have created a school system. I guess you could call it a system that's servicing a lot of children. So why don't you talk about that?
So way back in 93, 94, my father said, you know, that one way to bring about social change is through education. And the fact that he's, you know, he's someone who's basically a lawyer, but has had a long history of ideological kind of leanings towards a socialistic model of running a society where he feels that class system, feudalism must be, it is something which comes in the way. So he's rejected that. So as a lawyer, he had to pay his taxes. And he said, I don't want to pay taxes to corrupt government. So I'd rather set up our own school there with the money that I've not paid to the government. So he set up this school. Of course, the school was there with a vision. And the vision was really about teaching children how to think and teaching them how to be human beings rather than making them into very career-oriented individuals, which he thought in any case was happening in the society. So he wanted to target the poorest of the poor and girls in particular, because he thought it's the girls, it's the women of the society who were more receptive to change than the men were. Men were still stuck in many ways in their old ways of thinking. They're very rigid and conservative and traditional ways of looking at life, their children, raising their families. So he thought women and empowering girls and women would be a lot more effective and would have a lot more impact in terms of social change. So it's like this, you know, they say you teach a girl and you teach a family. You educate a girl, you educate a child, and you educate a home. So he set up this school way back in 94, 95, and the school started off as a small primary school just for the poor girls of a suburb of Lahore, where mostly the industry, it was an industrial area, and a lot of these young girls were the children of laborers, and their fathers were either working these factories or they were fruit vendors. They were very poor. These were the first generation who were really going to school. So the school was set up way back then. Now the school is right up till grade 12, right up till college. And we have about 750 children attending the school, and it has its own purpose-built campus. And now not only it's targeting the children, the girls of these poor families, but also in the second shift, we have the boys coming in because the family, on the demand of the community and the families, they said, you know, this school has done so much with our life and with our children that we don't want our boys to be deprived of this kind of education. So the school is really about giving quality education free of cost.
Been talking with Bina Raza, educator and social entrepreneur in Lahore, Pakistan, about the challenges of education in her country. The second time that Danyal Muinuddin has been a guest on Tidings. The first time as a writer, just after he had won a major prize for his book of short stories, In Other Rooms, Other Wonders. This time he was talking to me as a Pakistani farmer. He and his wife run a small farm in southern Punjab that produces sugarcane, wheat, cotton, mangoes, and vegetables.
I've just been taken with this idea that I hear education, education, wherever I go. And I certainly don't remember that in the past, living here. So if you could just talk a bit about how you see this, what would you call it, a new interest, a demand, or?
I guess it is new. I mean, I think what we're seeing, Hazel, is that there's been a sort of a filtering down, probably you would call it, from the urban middle class, which I saw even in my, you know, in the 70s. My mother was involved with trying to get various people educated in Lahore, and found that at that time there was a hunger among, you know, people in the city. But I think what you're now seeing is that this is expanded into the countryside, and that there is, you know, a great hunger to, you know, the way you can see it is to say that when people in the countryside get it all affluent, which means that they can afford 500 rupees the cost to educate a kid, the first thing they do is buy a bike. The second thing they do is buy a motorcycle. But right after that is education. Clearly, this newly created force or impulse.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me just say, when you were saying security, I was thinking that in the old days, and I'm sure that's still true, is that people would think that if they had sons rather than daughters, that would help them secure their old age.
Right.
You are just hands in the fields kind of thing.
Yeah. In a way, that sort of that thing has failed, Hazel. I mean, I think that belief still prevails. But the problem is that because there are no jobs, really, which is another really interesting part of this whole story, therefore people are finding that, in fact, more mouths to feed are just more mouths to feed. It depends on what, you know, sector of society you're talking about, of this place you're talking about, at what level. But among the very poor, or among the poorish, by the poorish, I mean people who more or less are secure in getting enough food, these guys, having more kids is not any more a workable solution to security. The guy who has a farm next to me pays his men 3,000 rupees, which is, you know, on 3,000 rupees, you can't eat more than, you know, sort of dry bread, basically. We pay our guys 10,000, our lowest salary is 10,000 rupees.
This is a month?
A month. 10,000 rupees would be about $110 a month. And then, but we also give interest-free loans, and we give medical, and we give other, you know, there are other benefits. Partly I do this because I feel that it's the right, but also I think it's a good business. And I found that it is good business, that I get to hire sort of the cream of the crop. And these guys, because they know that they can't find another job that's as good as the one I give, they work harder. But let me talk about the demand for education a little bit more. What you're seeing in the countryside that I'm observing is that the place is becoming more stratified. And that's because there's hugely accelerating population growth. And therefore, even at the lower levels, guys who have no land are desperate. And these are the guys who, as I was just saying, who are hired by the guy next to me for 3,000 rupees a month. They have no option for that job or no job, and they'll take anything. And these guys are completely screwed. These are the ones who don't have any land. On the other hand, what you're also seeing is that the ones who have even 1 acre, 2 acres, or 5 acres, because of high commodity prices, these guys are actually doing quite well. And these are the people who are now, because of the high commodity prices in their pocket, and what I'm seeing is the first thing these guys do is want to educate their kids. And so in my area, what's happened is that there are all these for-profit schools that have popped up. And I mean, within 3 kilometers of my farm, I've seen there have been three new schools that have popped up in the past year. So these guys who are, as soon as they have anything, they're that's what they're doing, sending their kids to these places. And the reason for this is that because people have come to understand understand that their jobs are very difficult to get. And if you want, you know, if you want your kid to have even a chance of getting the kind of job in which they can support you in your old age, in a manner to which you will become accustomed, they have to be educated.
So these private for-profit schools, who puts those up?
Two of them next to me, just this guy who's a farmer. You know, he has like 25, 30 acres. And he just somehow struck upon this idea. He had nothing to do with education. He simply thought that this would make sense as a business.
It's just another crop for him, maybe.
Yeah, effectively, yeah, I think so. But one, you know, I mean, look, I applaud him. The problem is that I don't think he's doing a very good job. He's paying his women nothing. I think somebody told me that he's paying his teachers 1,500 rupees a month. And he can get away with that because these are girls, you know, these are girls who are sort of withering on the vine. They're not getting married. And either for economic reasons or because they don't want to get married. And these girls, you know, will work for almost anything because it's better than working, not having anything at all. So I don't think he's doing a great job. Clearly, but it's almost impossible to do worse than the government school, because the government school is basically completely ineffective.
So why do you want to have a school?
We roughly believe in tithing. So we try to invest in our community, you know, 10% of our income. And, you know, there are lots of reasons for this. One is that I'd like to sort of be able to sleep well at night. Another one is that I'd like to, you know, have the appearance in the neighborhood of being, you know, somebody who's not, you know, sort of a gold digger. Sort of feel that it improves the character of my village and of my immediate area, and that's something that is both desirable just as an absolute and also because it, in a way, serves me. I mean, you know, the smarter the guys around my area, in my immediate sort of purview are, the more likely the prosperity sort of snowballs. As a businessman, I think it's good for me to have in my area and the kids of the people who work for me to be sort of prosperous, because it means that people want to work for me, the people who work for me are happy, other people want to work for me.
And how does this help you also, I mean, imagine helps you be more secure against any of the, I don't know, insurgent, militant, Taliban, whatever, Jamaat-e-Islami elements that you might have in your community? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, Hazel, first of all, if you think that people are going to be grateful, you're wrong. People just aren't grateful. I mean, if you create a sort of a atmosphere of prosperity, you know, people will want to sort of belong to your club or your thing. That's true. But if you're saying that when the chips come, these guys are going to help you, I doubt if they would. Who they help will all be determined by, you know, their sort of kinship groups, and they will turn upon somebody like me in an instant. So it's true that you know, there is some degree of goodwill that is created, but I never give that very much weight. I don't think so. I think that if things go to hell, the fact that I educated somebody's kid, you know, there could be some strange circumstance in which it would help me, but I don't count on it in any way. The impression I get is that there's just increasing radicalization, clearly increasing radicalization in our, you know, in my area. You just don't know which one of these guys is going to take it upon himself to bump me off.
So you can't depend on their fealty anymore.
Exactly.
Although nationally the income gap between rich and poor in Pakistan is greater than it has ever been, a new affluence has come to the rural areas based on land ownership. It is no secret that much of this land is purchased with funds distributed via mosques and madrasas from Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. Formerly westernized, high-living Pakistani elites have transferred their allegiance to Saudi-based Wahhabism, exchanging their Savile Row suits and trips to Europe for beards and trips to Dubai.
All the people in your village and in your farm, they want them all to be followers of Wahhabi.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, you know, what you see is that the guys who 10 years ago were sort of, you know, going to Paris and dancing the can-can suddenly decided to grow beards and have their finest vacations be in Saudi Arabia. There's a sort of a co-opting of of the leadership of this movement by the same old faces.
But really, they used to be so Western before, and now they, instead of going to Paris, they go to Dubai or Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, you see that all the time. It's hilarious. This is only true out in the countryside. In the city, in fact, everybody's, you know, in the city is much more, the people are much more ambivalent about how Western they are.
Despite the embedded forces of corruption, militarism, and terrorism that are forcing Pakistan's troubled trajectory, we can shine light on the proud people who live in that country and who have chosen to contribute themselves to its betterment. Placing themselves in a historical context, they're able to see their daily lives as process and themselves as agents of change. We salute them. And let Bina Raza remind us that nothing, especially countries, can ever be captured as a single story.
I'm very proud to be a Pakistani because of the very rich culture and heritage that this land has. And it is not just 63 years old, it is thousands of years old. You know, one of the oldest civilizations. We are the seat of one of the oldest civilizations, the Indus Valley civilization. Remember, Harappa was here, Mohenjo-Daro was here, this 3,000-4,000 BC. And this was the cradle of one of the oldest civilizations. So we are coming from that ethos. Unfortunately, like all societies, they go through their rise and fall. So we are going through a very dark period, for sure. But we are very hopeful that we will be one day, we'll be out of this phase and the sun will rise very soon. But I do, because I was part of a generation when we saw that it was, this land was not the way things are now. It was not, we were never branded as terrorists or extremists. We were branded as you've lived in this city and you've been associated with this part of the world. So, through you and through your program, I would like to spread this message out to the world that Pakistanis are not terrorists, we are not extremists, and I would really urge people to get to know the real Pakistan, the real Pakistani people, and I would really urge everyone to understand where we're coming from and to spread a message, a positive message of love and tolerance, that we are people who want to, like anyone else, we want to embrace life, we want to celebrate life, and that's how it is.
And the forces of enlightenment, you know, arising out of a government that is completely indifferent to its people. But just because the government is indifferent to its people doesn't mean the people are indifferent to each other.
Absolutely.
And you know, these forces of enlightenment that I've encountered in my stay here in Lahore are really very inspiring, and so we will bring these voices.
You've been listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan about the critical state of education in Pakistan. For more information, please visit tidingsfromhazel.org. Tidings can be heard on the second Wednesday of each month at 6:30 p.m. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.